This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Yeehaw, boys and girls. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We will be talking about elections here on Halloween. I think that's scary enough. 11 o'clock here on the Wake Up Call. Thank you so much. It is a special shout out to those on Harrisonburg on 95.1, as well as to those at Dixon Disposal for their support. Dixon reminds you that you can reduce household garbage by purchasing products with reuse and recycling in mind. Small changes in your lifestyle can keep our planet green for years to come. When Dixon's picks up your trash, they sort and separate it for recycling. You can help the planet stay green with curbside service from Dixon Disposal at your home or business. More by phone at 434-978-2111 or online at DixonDisposal.com. All right, let's introduce our guest, and here's my fearful part of the program. Jim Slavka, how are you?
I'm doing well, Rick. Thanks for having me back.
Are you talking into the proper microphone?
I think I am.
One more time.
Morning, Rick. How are you?
There we go. Let's just get a little closer to that. Don't be afraid of that microphone, because Sean McCord and I actually have that that thing working today. All right, Jim Slavka here. An adjunct at the Federal Executive Institute, adjunct faculty, politics, all kinds of special stuff over there. They do some weird stuff over there. Invite government officials to come down for 2 weeks, live high on the hill, learn a lot about better use of their time and training for leadership.
Well, it's actually usually 4 weeks, and it's a terrific program because we teach them not only leadership and some management skills, but also a lot of content as well. I teach mostly politics, European politics mostly, but also American and international relations. And so it's a wonderful contribution to the community and also helps our government, I think, create stronger leaders and executives.
And for those of you who know Charlottesville, that's what that white building is, high up on the hill across from Lord Hardwick's and Long John Silver's. So it's a good smell all the time while you're out and around the building. All right, we are going to talk midterm elections and throw a little special interest in there on the 5th District, which a lot of the WNRN folks are involved in, down to Lynchburg and Appomattox from Charlottesville on. So we will be spending some special time on that topic. Please write down the number. Dial up with your questions or comments if you'd like. 979-0919. 979-0919. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. We'll be taking calls in a short time. Jim Slavka from Federal Executive Institute, let me just jump in with, I guess, a really broad question is, what are typical happenings in midterm elections? Because people always say, oh, well, look what happened back to, is it 1994 when Clinton his first 2 years, and then they gave it back to the Republicans. And but is that every 2 years during a new president's time in office?
Well, generally speaking, Rick, 1994, we could talk about that separately. That's sort of the granddaddy of midterm changes. But it is typical that the president's party will lose seats in the House of Representatives and frequently in the Senate. And that's just sort of a natural progression of American politics that seems to occur midway in a president's term. In 1982, President Reagan lost a tremendous number of seats in the House. In 1974, this was a few months after President Nixon resigned over the Watergate scandal, the Republicans took a beating in House elections. 1994, of course, and of course, in 2006, in President Bush's second term, the midterm elections of Bush's second term, the Democrats took control of the House as well. Now, 1994 was tectonic in the sense that the Republicans, not only did the party change power in the House and Senate, but it changed by an unbelievable magnitude, and it was largely unexpected. While the Democrats were concerned going into 1994 that they would lose seats, the idea that the sitting House Speaker would lose his own reelection race was not something that most people were, the pundits were prognosticating on in that time, which is why 94 was such a shock. In 2010, we're gearing up for another cycle where it appears likely that the Republicans will regain control of the House of Representatives. I don't think they will in the Senate, but they will increase the number of seats in the Senate. And so, but unlike in 1994, this is largely anticipated. All eyes actually are expecting a changeover. So for the Democrats, the expectation game is sort of against them, which means if they do better than expected, this could be credit. The president could use this as sort of it may be cold comfort as a way to argue that things weren't as bad as they could have been.
But you said that that there are a couple different instances when it was sort of grandiose. But you also said that it sort of happens on a regular basis, at least in some percentage. Is this because Americans are continuously dissatisfied, and so it's every 2 years you're out, you're in, and you get the opportunity to do what I want or what I feel that we need?
Partly, there's a natural American tendency to sort of want to check and balance, and you see a lot of attempts where you'll vote in 1 year for a president. 2 years later, I would call it a phrase of buyer's remorse. You vote, perhaps things have not improved or done as well as you thought they were when you voted for president, so now you're going to vote for the other party in power. I mean, political scientists have long studied this phenomenon going back to the 40s, and it is a fairly regular cycle of the president's party losing seats. Another problem, of course, is that the party that's out of power, the party that has lost the presidential race, which this year would be the Republicans, are generally more energized and animated to get power back. Those in power become a little bit more complacent. This was certainly the case with the Democrats in 1994. And so the energy tends to go to the opposition party naturally because they see greater stakes for themselves in winning the election. Now, again, this is relatively routine in American politics, but the big ones, the most realigning midterm elections besides 2006 would be 94 and 82. Now, in 82, there were a lot of prognosticators that were writing President Reagan off in the middle of his first term. People were thinking that Reagan was on the ropes, he was going to be in political trouble. And as we know, Reagan went on to coast to re-election in 1984 and left office in January of 89 with still a high degree of popularity. So while it's to be assumed that the president's party will lose seats, it is not automatic that the sitting president will not be elected in the next election. Clinton, of course, in 96 also coasts to a comfortable re-election and also has a fairly popular second term like Reagan.
The way I see it, much of the commentary seems to be directed at the House of Representatives. Now, that may possibly be because there's 435 elections ongoing as opposed to 30 plus in the Senate, and the presidential election is not occurring. It seems to be more of a scorecard from what we did 2 years ago and what we might do 2 years future. But it also seems that what I hear is that the bad commentary is somewhat on President Obama, but in a smashing manner on Ms. Pelosi. Is that because there were 435 elections in which she has reason to be attached to? Or is that because she actually has more negative feelings towards her?
A little bit of both. I mean, one thing that's been interesting in this campaign, Tip O'Neill always argued that all politics is local. And to some extent, what we're seeing in 2010 with the rise of YouTube and the internet is the opposite. All politics is national. And the classic case of this is the Delaware Senate race, where Christine O'Donnell of the famous I Am Not a Witch cartoon campaign ad argued, I say cartoon because she's been villainized in a lot of press by as a cartoon figure. O'Donnell's campaign has run a campaign largely ignoring Delaware entirely and focusing only on national Republican issues. And she's gotten a lot of mileage out of this. Pelosi, you're right, in focus groups in the Republican Party has polled with a very low approval rating. That's not to argue these are right or wrong, but just looking at this in, from the standpoint of politics and political strategy, since Speaker Pelosi is polling as a highly unlikable figure, particularly in Republican circles, it's only logical that she would be used in campaign ads as sort of the bogeyman of the opposition. And the one of the reasons for this is that Pelosi's name is associated with the health care bill, which is almost universally reviled by Republican-leaning voters this route. So it's sort of a double win for Republicans to tag each of those 435 races to Pelosi, largely because that health care bill was a talisman that they want to use to attack her with. Now, just, you know, to sort of set the stage for this, Rick, to go further, let's establish for the listeners what the stakes are here. In terms of just the basic electoral math, the Republicans need to gain 39 seats in the House of Representatives to get Pelosi out as Speaker and make John Boehner of Ohio would be the likely successor to her. So 39 in the House. In the Senate, they need 10. The current distribution is 59-41, but since Vice President Biden, a Democrat, could vote in the case of a tie, the Republicans need 10 seats to gain mastery in the Senate to bypass Biden's role as a potential tiebreaker. But there's something else going on here, Rick, that's been underreported in the media, and that is the governor's races. Now, normally in a standard midterm cycle, you wouldn't be focusing that much on governor's races, except, you know, maybe one or two. But this happens to be a redistribution year. The census occurred in 2010, and all 435 House seats, the total apportionment of seats in the House, get redistributed among the states based on the census every 10 years. That process of reallocation is left to the state legislatures to decide. And so control of state houses is extremely important this year. So not only do you have this House and Senate race going on, you're going to now be looking at, just because of the calendar, coincidentally, it's 2010, and we have to redistribute seats in the House. So the political stakes this year are much higher than they normally would be if it were just a legislative election in the House and Senate.
One of the interesting things, and we will be getting into the 5th District here in Virginia as a major part of the conversation during the hour here with Jim Sofka from the Federal Executive Institute, is that the 5th District here in Virginia is larger than the state of New Jersey.
That's right. It is.
I found that to be just overwhelming. I had no idea about that. But as we talk about the elections, and you toss in the information about the governors through here, we also have the Tea Party, which we've discussed here on this program before. In fact, just for people who want to know, back in May, Mr. Pelosi was a guest on the program. Back in Mr. Perriello, Ms. Pelosi, I don't think would come over. Mr. Perriello was a member, a guest on the program, but Mr. Clark and Mr. Hurt, despite being invited multiple times, there was no even follow-up on their end, to no return call, no return email. But the Tea Party candidates in several races throughout the nation have had a big play. They've been a major part of the play card. You mentioned Delaware, but there are some areas throughout the United States where the candidate from the Tea Party is expected to win, not just be a factor in pulling votes from someone else's total.
Yeah, let's look at that. The Tea Party, my prediction on the Tea Party, which squares with, I think, a lot of political scientists, is that third-party movements generally get absorbed into, if not one, if not or both, of the major parties. We saw this in the 1990s with Ross Perot's Reform Party, which did very well in the 1992 presidential election. And then members of the Reform Party sort of split in their allegiances. Some went with Clinton, some went over back to the Republican Party, where a lot of them had come out of. The Tea Party, generally speaking, is trending Republican. They're maintaining their independence from the Republican Party structure, but generally speaking, Tea Party members are going to vote for the Republican candidate. Now, Delaware was a surprise case where O'Donnell beat Mike Castle, who was an establishment Republican figure in Delaware politics for a long time. In Alaska, where Joe Miller beat out Lisa Murkowski, as the Tea Party candidate, beating an established Republican, although Murkowski is now running an independent write-in bid in Alaska and doing very well. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't be surprised if she wins, simply on the virtue of name recognition. But the granddaddy fight right now is, of course, Nevada, where Sharon Angle, who won the Tea Party nomination, is fighting Harry Reid, who's the Senate Majority Leader. And that's one of the reasons why this race is attracting so much attention, is simply because, since given Reid's position in the Senate, a lot of Republicans want to bring him down. So you're absolutely right. The Tea Party scored some very impressive victories, especially in the primary season in the spring against Republicans. But in the general election now, more of them are going back into the Republican fold. And I think after, for example, in 2012, our next election cycle, I'm going to be interested to see if the Tea Party continues to exist as an independent organization, or whether, if the Republicans take the House, they will become subsumed back into the Republican Party architecture.
Rick Moore here on WNRN's Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. We're speaking about midterm elections with Jim Sofka, Federal Executive Institute. Jim, Tea Party candidates, let's talk about 5th District here specifically. Jeff Clark,
mm-hmm,
running because he felt that Robert Hurt was not conservative enough, brought himself in, made points that if he was not a viable candidate late in the election, that he would step out. Has not done so, despite, I believe, the last poll I saw, he had 4% of the poll. I guess in his issue, that makes him still a viable candidate. But 2 years ago, when Mr. Perriello won against Virgil Goode, it was 700 and some votes?
727.
So how destructive to Robert Hurt's candidacy might Mr. Clark be?
Well, the Perriello campaign is hoping that it's extremely destructive, and that's one of the reasons why Mr. Perriello has, in my opinion, very wisely gone out of his way to include Clark in every debate, in every possible way that he can, in order to keep Clark viable. As a matter of fact, he's complimented Clark by saying, you know, if you really want to vote for a principled conservative, particularly on economic issues, because that's sort of what Mr. Clark has made as his stock in trade, then you should vote for Clark, not Hurt. And Perriello is doing this because any kind of a third party dynamic is going to hurt in the sense that, if it's not to alliteration there, hurt. And I think that Perriello's campaign, frankly, I think Perriello's run one of the best campaigns in the United States, and that's one of the reasons why it's getting so much attention. I mean, he not only is the 5th District, as you alluded to, Rick, geographically large, you know, the state of New Jersey comparison comes up, but it's also quite diverse. You have fairly conservative South Side, and you have fairly liberal, pro-democratic Charlottesville area. So you've got to cover a lot of bases representing this district. It's not as monolithic as other congressional districts, and it's a tough one to run from. So with Clark, yeah, he's going to probably wind up doing, I think 4% is probably generous. I would assume on Tuesday that Clark pulls maybe between 2 and 3% of the vote. Now, is that going to be enough to change the election? I'm not sure. Just about every poll out there shows Hurt ahead of Perriello, but the spread varies. I was looking at a poll of polls, and they go from as low as about a 1.72% lead over Perriello to some that are saying 20%, which I think is just ridiculous. So the district, most pundits have put the 5th District as leaning Republican. Whether or not Clark and the dynamic of Clark would be able to swing it right now based upon the polling data. You'd have to say no since it's being put into the Republican column. But of course, if this comes down to another nail biter, fewer than 1,000 votes, then obviously analysts are going to be looking at this one for a long time to come, and the Clark factor could be extremely important. Right now, it doesn't appear to be, but Perriello has been playing it for all it's worth and doing it extremely effectively.
I also read where, and for many know that President Obama was in Charlottesville on Friday.
It's kind of hard to miss.
to help promote Mr. Perriello. And my understanding is that that is the only time during this election season that he has been to support one single candidate. And so I think, as you said, that shows the importance not just of Mr. Perriello as the candidate, but it's almost a bellwether for what's going on. 11:20 here on the Wake Up Call with Jim Sofka. As we talk about midterm elections, with a special inclusion of the 5th District here in Charlottesville, call up if you have a question or a comment, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN Rocks. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Mostly sunny today, highs of 67. Clear tonight, chilly low 36. Mostly sunny tomorrow, highs of 54. Right now, it's pretty and clean out in the area. Fair in the valley at 61, 63 in Lynchburg, 63 in Richmond, a few clouds, and 64 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let me give a thanks to Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for supporting us today. They now feature the Columbia Omni Heat, a waterproof down jacket with 700 fill power to provide protection from wet and cold weather. Columbia Omni Heat jackets are available at Blue Ridge Mountain Sports, the outdoor store that knows the outdoors. And Relay Mountain Foods. Where did that come from? How about RelayFoods.com? I don't know that they particularly serve the mountains, but they are serving Charlottesville and Richmond. RelayFoods.com is the place to go for locally grown food and groceries from your favorite local stores and restaurants. You can order until midnight. It'll be ready by 3 p.m. the next day. Your shopping done. RelayFoods.com lets you save time, beat traffic, and get the food you need from sources you know and trust. That's RelayFoods.com. And I see the phone's ringing now, 979-0919 ringing, but the toll-free line of 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS also available as we're here with Jim Sofka from Federal Executive Institute. Jim, you wanted to follow up with President here in town?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Rick, because this is a bellwether race from the White House's perspective. If Perriello can win, even if they lose control of the House, it demonstrates that the campaign on which Congressman Perriello has built his reelection effort is one that is proven and can potentially work in a Republican-leaning district. There's a lot going on here. It is a bellwether, and Mr. Perriello has run a very Clintonian campaign. This is a congressman who's associated with Obama, but also has got the approval of the National Rifle Association, which most Democrats would not have. So he's been able to hew to a relatively centrist line, and the White House is going to be interested to see how this plays. Also, the fact that he won by such a narrow margin. He's been targeted as one of the number one congressmen the Republicans wanted to take out, makes him more important to defend. Charlottesville is only a short flight away from the Washington, and it amounted not only to a way for the president to come down to the downtown mall and bump up Democratic Charlottesville, because Mr. Perriello has to get strong turnout on Tuesday. He's got to get just about anybody who's going to vote Democratic has got to come out in order for him to be reelected, but it amounted to a free airtime in a commercial form because all of the Charlottesville stations, the Newsplex, NBC 29, covered the entirety of that rally live, the ABC station in the Valley. So this amounted to free airtime for about 90 minutes across the district. So it was a political windfall for Perriello to have the president here simply because he got a lot more TV time for nothing than he normally would get.
We have a call from Charlie here in Charlottesville. Charlie, you with me?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. Question, comment?
My question. maybe I haven't been paying as close attention as I should have, but it seems to me that maybe Mr. Perriello wanted to use Mark Warner a little bit more in this campaign to campaign with him, and just wonder if you could comment on that. Thank you.
All right.
He has in some cases. That's actually that's a very good point, because Warner would represent sort of the archetype of the Perriello model, because Warner is someone who's you sort of called a NASCAR Democrat. He's someone who can appeal to a lot of centrist, even a lot of Republican voters, which is something that Perriello wants to do and given the scope of his district has to do, just given the population. But I think that from the perspective of Perriello bringing in Obama late in the campaign, I think that this obviously has been worked on for a long time. You don't just bring the president down to Charlottesville at short notice. So once he realized, and I'm assuming that had to be at least 30 days ago, that this began to be put into the works just to get the logistics, once he realized that he would have the president here, that sort of trumped all other considerations and was going to give him a lot more of a bump than bringing in Senator Warner. Senator Warner has also been devoting a lot of his time. It's interesting, since he's been in Washington, he has been working a lot more on less broad political issues, less what I would call broad appeal issues, and focusing a lot on the rules of the Senate. This is something that, you know, if time permits, we can go into a little bit this morning. It's an extreme area of importance. What Warner has been focusing on is trying to change the filibuster rules and the secret holds in the Senate. And so he's been less visible on the state political stage and on the national political stage, focusing a little bit more and drilling into the rules and procedures as of how the Senate does business. But I think that absolutely Charlie's right, that using Warner would help. It's a natural fit for Perriello. But once he knew that he had Obama, you know, that sort of ace in the hole, he played it for all it was worth.
Still, you say that would have been 30 days ago. Why hasn't Warner? And I think many would have said that since June, anyway, when Hurt became the Republican candidate, why didn't he start then? Or even before then? You couldn't possibly have assumed that this would have been an easy election.
I'm not sure. Yeah, fair points. I'm not entirely sure of what Warner has given him support. They are not as close as Perriello is with the Obama administration and is identified. And I believe that Perriello felt that at first, keeping his distance and running as his own man, this was something that he's focused on quite a bit, because he's actually broke with the House leadership on a number of issues and the president. I think he decided that he was going to run this campaign his way on his own. And the White House took notice of this. The White House took notice that Perriello was fighting pretty well in the 5th District and decided to give Perriello its support. So, you know, again, depending upon what happens Tuesday, we're either going to sit back and say that Perriello ran one of the greatest campaigns that's ever been run for Congress, or we'll look back and look and see what the numbers come down and look at the poll, the raw data, and see that, you know, maybe deploying Mark Warner Southside might have been a smarter move. Maybe getting Obama in earlier, not getting in Obama at all. We're not going to know that until we get a lot of the exit poll data after Tuesday.
11:27 here in the wake-up call with Jim Sofka from Federal Executive Institute, as we talk about midterm elections with a special focus on the 5th District. Let me thank Blue Ridge Graphics for allowing us to be on air today. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street here in Charlottesville, providing custom T-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, online, brgtshirts.com. All right, we got a call from Mark here in Charlottesville. Hey, Mark.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. Bring it on. What you got?
I guess I just had a two-part question. I'll just hang up and listen. I guess first part is, why is there a criticism of Barack Obama as a socialist? Second of all, with that, I was driving along 29, just over on Pantops, and there's a sign on the side of the road that says Perriello, and below it says socialist. So I didn't know how that applied, and if you could enlighten the listeners as to how being a socialist would apply to Barack Obama.
Thanks, man.
Bye.
Great question. It brings up the political theorist in me. Yeah, the word socialist has been overused. What socialist means, and political theorists would and political scientists would all put this forward, is someone who favors the state control of industry and putting the economy under state control. And Republican focus groups have found that that word is certain, is one that animates the American voters. It's one that's considered a dirty word in American politics. And so just like in the early 1990s, there were a lot of very expensive ad campaigns and focus groups that discovered that the word liberal was a dirty word in American politics. If you can call, you know, using liberal was a swear word, and therefore Republicans began to put liberal after just about every Democrat in the country, including many who were anything but liberal. So is Barack Obama a socialist? No. And I don't say this as an Obama supporter or critic. It's just not a word that's appropriate. They're trying to portray him as sort of a Swedish social democrat. Yes, the American government bailed out big business, but this was also backed by a lot of Republicans and was something that, given the financial collapse, had to be done. And the American government had majority stake in General Motors, but Obama made very clear that he did not want to nationalize our banks or our automotive industry and wants to get rid of them as soon as possible. Now, what's interesting is how, and Mark's question is terrific because, you know, I've seen this same argument, Barack Obama is a socialist. And I think to myself, well, if Barack Obama is a socialist, then Richard Nixon must have been a Trotskyite communist, because his health care bill of 1970 that he and Ted Kennedy worked on was vastly more to the left than anything Obama and Pelosi put together. His family assistance plan that Pat Moynihan put together in 1971 would have made it a right for families to get a cash payout from the federal government, which no Democrat today is going to put forward for fear of immediately losing an election. So our politics in this country, and those of you on the right will agree, those of you on the left won't, I mean, I'm just here to analyze, not to sort of put my own two cents in on this, have moved to the right. And what you saw coming out of Washington, again, in the late 60s and early 70s, was a far bigger government with a far larger footprint than what you see today. But to answer the question very simply, socialist is one of those words that energizes people, that rallies a base, and so the Republicans are using it for everything they can because they want to get back the House.
11:31 on the Wake Up Call. Dial up with your question or comment, 979-0919. That's 979-0919. If you're further away throughout the state, maybe Richmond's 1031, or a little further south, Levinson's 94.7, Lynchburg's 89.9. Also in the 5th District, it's the toll-free 1-877-967-6762. Jim Sofka here, Federal Executive Institute. Adjunct faculty. Jim, I had other guests invited today. I had someone who felt uncomfortable coming on because of their questions possibly late in the program or late in the election cycle, giving away their personal feelings. But I have a question from that person. And it follows up with the socialism. If a healthcare program that so many are against because of its socialist leanings, how can these same people be satisfied with Medicare and Medicaid? What is the difference between the two, between those two sides?
It's a great question, and a number of focus groups that were held, paid for by nonpartisan interest groups, but also by the Democratic Party, found surprisingly that a lot of Americans did not know or didn't want to believe that Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security were run by the United States government. So when you talk about big government and government spending, you're talking social benefits like Medicare and Medicaid, but you're also talking purchasing aircraft carriers and fighter planes. I mean, the government spends a lot of money in our economy. Now, is this the health care bill that was passed in 2009 after a lot of fanfare and a lot of political slog? I actually think that my personal opinion is that that bill was the right fight at the wrong time for the president, but that's another issue. Is if you want to use the word socialist, is nothing compared to what you see in France or Great Britain or even Canada to our north. It's a plan that mandates that all Americans have to buy health insurance, but health insurance can come from the private sector, as opposed to what's called a single-payer system, which is where the government becomes essentially the insurer and the government pays doctors. That's the way it is in the national health system, for example, in Great Britain. So our system, compared to other major industrial world powers, our peer competitors in the G20, is among the most conservative. And don't forget that, you know, many of European states, the first sort of single-payer system was adopted in the 1880s in Germany by Chancellor Bismarck. So we're actually a little behind the times on this. And again, yes, if you want to sort of parse things out, if somebody says, well, I don't like socialism, well, do you get a Medicaid check? Yes, I do. Do you get a Social Security check? I mean, not everything that comes from the government is socialism. When we, again, let's put this forward, and this is the professor in me coming out, I know, I'll try not to bore you, but socialism is when the government owns the means of production, when the government owns the auto companies and the banks and wants to own them as a matter of national policy. That's and then distributes their proceeds out. That's a socialist economy. Our economy is not socialist. It's very much private sector. And the Obama administration, as a matter of fact, broke with some on the further left of the political spectrum that wanted them to nationalize the banks. There were a lot of very liberal interest groups out there saying, hey, you know, let's nationalize the banks, take them over and reform them, take control of the auto industry. And the Obama administration didn't want to touch that. I personally don't think that they should. That's not something that the government should be doing. So when you are talking about government spending, we have to realize that when Republicans are out there screaming about government spending, then you have to ask them, well, what about defense spending and defense contractors? This was, you know, this is another form of the government spending cash. So the short answer to the question, Rick, is the old one in politics of whose ox is being gored. It's not a question of being anti-spending in theory. It's what are you spending the money on and where are the benefits going?
11:36 on the wake-up call. Rick Moore here with Jim Sofka. Follow up with your question. Or comment 9790919. We've already heard from Mark and Charlie. We'll put your name on the list, or you can remain anonymous if you choose. Jim, back to the larger picture. Get away from the Fifth District for a moment or two. It seems to be expected that the Democrats will at least lose power in the House.
Yes,
possibly in the Senate as well. But as you mentioned, a much harder road for them to do. How does this, people talk about, to go back to 94 when it happened in the Clinton era, and they went from having everything to having, you know, mixed power, but they got more done. Everyone seems to think that they'll just butt heads the whole time, but that's really all they've been doing for 2 years anyway. Will more get accomplished if this happens?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, Rick. I mean, what happened in the Clinton presidency was interesting. The Republicans took power, and again, this was a surprise takeover of the House and Senate. Gingrich became Speaker of the House of Representatives. The Contract of America became the Republican playbook. And the Republicans pushed hard on a conservative agenda, and this led to, for you know, to sort of keep the story short, to the government shutdown in 1995, where Clinton and the Republicans went head to head. The result was the government shutdown. And Clinton sort of masterfully, because he's an unmatched political campaigner. He loves politics and he knows how to play it rather well, sort of outmaneuvered Gingrich, and the American public sort of blamed the Republicans for that shutdown more than Clinton. Right or wrong, agree, disagree. I'm just talking about what the poll showed at the time. And what happened after that was curious, because Clinton realized that in order to be viable and effective, he has to do business with Gingrich and the Republicans. Gingrich then realized that he had reached his Waterloo, that the fact that Clinton outmaneuvered him on the shutdown meant that he wasn't going to be able to just throw bombs from the hard right, but was going to also have to compromise and cut deals. And so what happened was both sides began to work together. Small issues, these sort of, you know, it was called triangulation in the mid-1990s, which was basically to take the ideas from the other side that you could repackage as your own, where you had some common ground, At first, these were relatively small items, relatively uncontroversial. But by the end, by the 96, when Clinton's reelected, he and the House leadership had worked out at least the beginnings of a degree of compromise and comedy to get beyond what had happened in the shutdown. Of course, then the Lewinsky scandal happens in 98 and impeachment, and this becomes, you know, its own story. But the takeaway was that both the House leadership and Clinton at various stages decided that it was better to try and get deals than to simply paralyze the system by attacking each other. They did that, but you saw momentum where they could get it. So here's the question. Assuming that John Boehner becomes Speaker of the House, and John Boehner is no super hard right guy. He is a old school country club Republican from Ohio. He's somebody who actually got into fights with the Gingrich crowd in the 90s. He was drummed out of the House leadership in 98 for being too moderate. So Boehner's a guy who by instinct is a deal maker and is willing, I think, and able to work with the other side. President Obama, for his part, was actually criticized by a lot of Democrats for going out of his way to try to compromise with Republicans in 2009. And so I think that Boehner and Obama, as individuals, could work, assuming that's the dynamic. Republican House, Senate remains Democratic, but the Senate has been roughly paralyzed anyway, even with a larger Democratic majority, because individual senators have a lot of power to gum the works up in the Senate through threats of filibuster, through secret holds. So I don't think much is going to change in the Senate, even if the Democrats hold it and have with a reduced majority. Here's the question. In this age of viral videos and YouTube and massive blogosphere, which did not exist in the Clinton years, will Obama and Boehner be able to feel that they could cut deals with the other party, or is it more to their political advantage to do nothing and simply demonize and attack the other side? That is going to be a question of leadership and statesmanship that they're going to have to address. And that is something that right now we just don't know. So I could easily see 2 years of utter paralysis in Washington, D.C., where the Republicans will put forward a lot of bills that they know will never pass. They'll die in the Senate. Obama will run against the House. The House will run against the president. And nothing, I mean, nothing at all will get done. Or I could see both sides, as they did in the 1990s, realizing that the only way forward is by some degree of compromise and attempting to put together some kind of workable platform, at least on issues that are not of the highest priority to their respective bases.
11:41 here on the Wake Up Call with Jim Sofka.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Almost a year after Governor Tim Kaine announced the purchase of Biscuit Run as a state park, those on both sides of the aisle are questioning the secrecy that surrounds the deal. Albemarle County Schools battle Albemarle County parents over the proposed 4x4 class plan. And UVA's investigation of the Virginia Quarterly Review tragedy, is it a whitewash? The Hook, reminding you to vote Tuesday, November 2nd. And let's thank Ben Around Tattoos for their support. You can find them in Waynesboro, featuring male and female tattoo artists. Ben Around Tattoos has thousands of designs available and can create work from a design you provide as well. Piercing also available. Ben Around Tattoos in downtown Waynesboro or here in Charlottesville at 701 West Main Street. For more information online, benaroundtattoos.com. And because you were certainly listening last week, you already know November 4th through the 7th, it's the 2010 Film Virginia Film Festival. The festival takes over screens around Charlottesville next weekend and features documentaries, dramas, and comedies from smashes to experimental as well as underground fare. It's the 2010 Virginia Film Festival, also featuring scores of celebrity panels and lectures. It's virginiafilmfestival.org for more info, including full film descriptions and ticket ordering info. There's also a free iPhone app available from iTunes. And be listening to WNRN starting Monday, the 1st, tomorrow, for your chance to win tickets to selected screenings and events. All right, back with Jim Sofka. Jim, quick question. We're going to get to amendments in just a moment, because for those of you who, I mean, it's all been about election, but there are also some amendments in here in Virginia to vote on. 979-0919-1877-WNRN-ROCKS for information on those. But back to the 5th District a little bit, you mentioned the word demonize. Both major candidates, Robert Hurt, Tom Perriello, have been accused of recently putting together lie ads. I believe for Perriello is accused of saying that Robert Hurt voted for electrical power increases that have gone up. And I guess the truth, as is being reported by many, is that he didn't actually vote for that. He voted for something else that many people did at the time, and this was the outcome of it. But he didn't vote directly for something that led to that. And Perriello, the lie ad towards Perriello was that he voted lockstep with Pelosi, and in actuality, he is one of the lowest with that. I believe it's even under 80% in voting for everything that she wanted. Take a moment and talk about that. Just lie ads in this race.
Well, unfortunately, these become very commonplace at the end of a political campaign, where the ads tend to get a little bit nastier and you want to draw starker contrasts with your opponent. You're absolutely right with that, Rick. Both of these are, to put it most charitably, a distortion of the truth. Senator Hurt did vote for a utility bill that was relatively routine. A lot of people voted for it. It was not packaged as a quote-unquote tax rate increase. It had the effect downstream of affecting these rates, but it was something that at the time in the state Senate was not considered separately in that way as a revenue stream. But, you know, again, Perriello is trying to appeal to independents, conservative-leaning independents that will see anything that has to deal with rate increase, tax increase, especially in a bad economy, as being something that could swing their vote. And so what you're getting is a distortion, being economical with the truth, as George Orwell famously said, in terms of this ad. And ditto on the Hurt campaign. It's sort of, you know, both of them are canceling each other out on this. That, no, actually, Perriello and Pelosi are not close. Perriello is one of Pelosi's, you know, would if you're Nancy Pelosi, Perriello is not one of your best friends in her caucus in the House of Representatives. He's actually gone against her and the leadership on a number of issues, and is one of, as you had said, one of the least in terms of scoring his votes against hers compatible. But he's voted with her on a number of bills, to be sure, and he is a Democrat, and he is in the House caucus, so technically it's true that he's under this caucus. Both of these are distortions, and I predict that you'll probably see some final 11th-hour airing ads that are similar to this. You know, I won't comment it on it more than that, other than to say that, tragically, this happens on all sides in our political system, given the way that political advertising is done. There's been a number of ads that have been commented on in the country. Of course, we alluded to this earlier in the program, the O'Donnell, you know, I'm not a witch. I keep thinking whenever I see that of the Princess Bride, you know, I'm not a witch, I'm your wife. That ad was probably the one that's gotten the most airtime. It wasn't a negative ad. It was a positive ad in the sense that she wasn't going after her opponents. But if you look, for example, if you really want to see ugly, ugly campaigning, take a look on YouTube at the Nevada race, where Reid and Engel have been, you know, throwing just about everything after each other. Hurt and Perriello are in love with each other compared to what you see in Nevada. So, you know, look, this is a high-stakes race. They both want to win, and Hurt's lead over Perriello has dwindled, and therefore they're going to throw the kitchen sink after each other. I've never personally, as I live in Albemarle County, I'm an independent voter. I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I have never received as many phone calls by both sides in this race in 21 years of living in Albemarle County as this year.
It's true. Every time I come home, there are at least two, if not more, calls awaiting me. All right, let's see. We have a call from Kale from here in Charlottesville. Hi, Kale.
Hello. How are y'all doing?
It's a good day. What you got for us?
Well, I was just commenting on the issue of Senator Hurt's vote on the utility bill. You know, I'll agree with you all that it passed with overwhelming support. You know, he wasn't a standout vote one way or the other on that, but it was pretty well known that it was going to lead to significant rate increases at the time. This was the bill to come out of deregulation in 2007. And the bill, with a lot of push from Dominion, which obviously has a lot of political sway in Richmond, was pushing a fee structure that was guaranteeing some pretty significant rate increases, really tying the State Corporation Commission's hands so that they'd have to increase rates down the road. And, you know, there were about 14 or so members of the House, a few senators on the Senate side that spoke up against this and specifically raised the issue that there's going to be hell to pay when ratepayers see these rate increases. You know, I think Senator Harvey Morgan from Hampton Roads, or rather Delegate Harvey Morgan from Hampton Roads, a Republican, was one who really raised that issue on the floor of the House. So I think it is fair to say that that vote was very much a vote to raise rates. The utilities had their arguments for why they needed it at the time, but I think we're seeing that the payback from just giving in to what the utilities were requesting in 2007.
All right, Cale. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
I would say, yeah, I mean, the general framework of that is correct in the sense that this did come out of the deregulation with the State Corporation Commission and was predicted that it would lead to rate increases as opposed to voting directly. I mean, I guess is where you want to parse the ad. To say that Senator Hurt voted for a bill that at the time was predicted that could lead to rate increases, yes. The way that it's being framed, that it was a vote directly for, and again, this is where you get into the parsing of various phrases, is a little bit of a stretch. I agree generally with the caller on that. This was something that was passed by wide support. It was not directly to vote for an increase. It was voted as part of a package on deregulation that, while predicted to lead to rate increases, was not directly into the text of that bill. So, again, true enough or general truth in terms of the broad context, sure, you can make that argument, but the way that it was being presented was in a much more edgier context than I think the overall bill presented at the time, in the way that, in the spirit of that legislation back in 07 and 08, was a little different than the way it's being portrayed. Again, you know, to sort of, you know, not to split too many hairs on all these issues, I don't frankly think this is going to swing it. I don't think either of those, you know, calling Perriello an acolyte of Pelosi, looking at Hurt with this broader power deal and utility bill, you know, I don't think that these things are going to be game changers at the end of the day. I think that, you know, you're going to be looking at a much broader set of issues. But it's the result of this campaign becoming so intense and frankly more of a nail biter than anybody thought it was going to be. I mean, you know, but this is the second time this has happened. Everybody was talking good winning by a very large majority back in 2008.
All right, 11:52 here on the Wake Up Call. Jim Sofka here, Charlottesville's Federal Executive Institute as adjunct faculty, talking midterm elections and some events in the 5th District, a very important, they're all, it's a vote, folks. It's all important, but nationally getting a lot of attention. Even a mention on Jon Stewart's show, where President Obama was earlier this week. So, Jim, let's spend a few moments talking about the neglected to be mentioned issues, also as articles and constitutional amendments, et cetera, that will be on things. They're paragraphs to read, so I'm going to do my best. There are three of them. Paragraph number one. Amendment number one allows homeowners not less than 65 years of age, or excuse me, permanently and totally disabled to not pay. Is that correct?
Yeah, the amendments, what's interesting, Rick, is that all three of these are actually not attracting much attention at all. Nobody's out there lobbying for them or against them. They're just sort of out there. There's no real organization. You're right. The first one, current law said that localities can either partially or fully exempt individuals over 65 who are disabled from property taxes if they faced a, quote, extraordinary tax burden. That is, you know, if they could prove that this was something that was simply too large for them to pay. The proposed amendment liberalizes this a little bit by saying that localities can remove that extraordinary burden. Essentially, they've got the right to decide if individuals over the age of 65, disabled, what their property tax bill could be, partial exemption or full exemption. The second one, similar, also deals with property tax, and that would allow localities to decide whether they want to give a property tax partial or full exemption to veterans who are disabled. If the veteran can prove that their disability is 100% related to the service, that would be, for example, somebody who's injured, let's say, in combat, localities could give those individuals full or partial exemption from their property tax.
Oh, why are these things receiving such little attention, even?
Because
you're talking about tax purposes.
Yeah, but we're also talking, true, but
it's a big issue amongst the two candidates. Why isn't it a larger issue amongst the state as a whole?
The third one might be, but just to answer your question so far on these two, it's because the numbers in question are so low. Nobody predicts that there, first of all, look at that second one I just mentioned. You've got to be a veteran. You've got to have a 100% service disability that allows, we're not going to be talking here, fortunately, that we're going to be looking at that many people. That's going to radically change the revenue stream of the Commonwealth. And again, as it's predicted, what these bills do is give localities a little more power. Doesn't mean it's guaranteed. So Albemarle County, Charlottesville, Stanton can adopt these policies. Many of them could do this now. So what the Constitution amendment will do is just remove a little bit more breaks on those localities. And I think the answer to your question is it's just not that big of a deal in terms of revenue. Now, the third one could be more significant. And what that amendment proposes is that current constitutional law has the state keeping 10% of all tax revenues collected in the Commonwealth as part of the rainy day fund. The amendment proposes to increase that to 15%. So the state, therefore, can hold 5% more of its total aggregate revenue collection in the form of a rainy day fund. Argument for that is it provides the Commonwealth with more money for bad economic times. However, this one, because it is of broad statewide impact, could potentially reduce the amount of revenue that would be free for routine spending. In other words, you're putting more of it in escrow. What's curious to me, frankly, Rick, as an observer of politics, is that while, that 5% is not all that radical, this one also is not attracting a tremendous amount of scrutiny. You don't see a lot of people out there screaming that's too much money to save or that's not enough.
We are talking with Jim Sofka here about the midterm elections and the three amendments that are on the voting ballot as well. It is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. And as we wind up our hour, let me thank Sugar Snap for supporting us. They offer gently used baby and kids items, including shoes and hats, plus maternity and nursing clothes. You'll also find cloth diapers, nursery gear, as well as some locally made items at Sugar Snap. They have a kid-friendly play area, and you can become a fan of Sugar Snap socially online, Facebook or Twitter. More SugarSnapConsignment.com. You can find them in Shoppers World Court. Jim, we were chatting up in the last minute or two about the amendments. The thing I have a hard time understanding is why government should have any rainy day fund. Isn't government supposed to be, this is what we need, this is what we take, we only spend what we need?
Yeah.
We can't get any more, so we can't spend any more.
But Virginia has always been a very conservative economic state, and it has a biennial budget in the sense that you have a budget that's passed for 2 years, not a single year. And also the argument for a rainy day fund, which I generally support, is that you could get flukes in individual years with tax revenue. That is, your projected income coming in may not be what it is. So having a small percent set aside is smart, just as an individual family should keep some savings because the unexpected may happen. That's the logic. And again, it's based upon our biennial budget. I should also say, Rick, just because I know we're closing down here, just general information, polls in Virginia open at 6 a.m. They close at 7 p.m. I encourage everyone out there to vote. This is going to be an important election. It's an election that's going to potentially have national implications. A lot of it being, you know, waged right here in the 5th district for those in that listening in that district. So 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. get out there and vote as always.
What is the expected drop off? Because there is an expected drop off. And is it based on gender, socioeconomic status?
I don't have, generally speak, as a general rule, turnout is highest among upper, higher educated, higher income. I was just looking at some statistics on this, and both the city and the county are expecting, I think the city's expecting about 39% turnout, the county's expecting about 42%. These are statements that I saw from the registrars. I hope it's more than that. I hope that that doesn't prove to be.
Compared to what? From 2008?
Down from 52 to 55%.
All right. Jim, thank you so much.
Thanks, Rick. Always a pleasure.
Next week, Jim Henderson and Diana Poe will be here to talk about drop-off status in the high school system. Please go vote. Adios.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.